Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law.
See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Billboard.com Pop Shop Podcast. My name is Keith Caulfield, and I am the co-director of charts at Billboard. The Billboard Pop Shop Podcast is your one-stop shop for all things pop on Billboard's weekly charts. In addition, you can always count on a lively discussion about the latest pop news, fun chart stats and stories, new music, and guest interviews with music stars and folks from the world of pop. Today on the show, we've got Coming Around Again with Billboard.com Senior Associate Editor Andrew Unterberger. Andrew will be speaking with Billboard contributor Eric Spitznagel about one of my favorite albums, INXS's Kick. The album is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year, and Andrew and Eric talk about the piece Eric wrote for Billboard about the album and its fascinating and contentious backstory, in which the band's manager claims they were offered $1 million by their disgruntled label to delete the album and start over. Of course, the album that they didn't delete went on to be a career-defining release for the act, sell millions and millions of copies around the world, and it still sounds modern and fresh today. But first, before we get started, if you enjoy the podcast, subscribe to the show on iTunes so you won't miss an episode, and give us a rating or a review while you're at it. And if you want to explore more podcasts from Billboard, visit iTunes.com/BillboardPodcasts. So, Kick is truly one of my favorite albums ever, and simply one of the best albums of the 1980s. It is such a great album, and full of familiar hits that you probably know. The album reached number 3 on the Billboard 200 chart, and is the band's highest charting effort. And it launched 4 top 10 singles on the Billboard Hot 100. Devil Inside, New Sensation, Never Tear Us Apart, and their only number 1 hit, Need You Tonight. The Grammy Award-nominated album would eventually be certified 6 times platinum by the Recording Industry Association of America, and as noted earlier, it still sounds fresh and cool today, 30 years later. So, let's go back to 1987 with INXS's Kick on Coming Around Again. So smile over here and give me a moment. Your moves are so raw. I've got to let you know. I've got to let you know. Hello, and welcome to Coming Around Again, Billboard's anniversary theme podcast dealing with anniversaries in the music world. Today we're celebrating the 30th anniversary of INXS's Kick album, which came out October 19th, 1987. Really came to define the band's career, made them superstars. Never quite lived up to it afterwards, but you're here to talk about the album with us is a guy who did a really interesting story that's going to be appearing in Billboard magazine this week, and that's Eric Spitznagel. What's up, Eric?
Not too much, Andrew. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. So why don't we kind of start with talking about your own experiences with INXS? I mean, were you a fan of theirs growing up? What do you remember about INXS in the late 80s and when this album came out?
I was in my mid to late teens, like 16 or 17 when Kick came out. Mm-hmm. And I remember being transfixed by it. I mean, it was not necessarily the type of music I was listening to, but most of what was on the radio was like Michael Jackson and Debbie Gibson and Rick Astley and Tiffany and the Dirty Dancing soundtrack. And I remember it came on MTV, and I was just, me and some of my friends were just like looking at Michael Hutchins. It's like, are we doubting our sexuality right now? Something weird is going on.
I'm sure you were not alone in that.
Exactly. So it was, I mean, it seemed so not even such a different type of sound than what we are used to hearing on the radio and on MTV, but we couldn't really even wrap our heads around, like, is this dance music? Is this rock music? I mean, is it some kind of hybrid of all of that? It seemed very confusing. I remember that.
Yeah, I mean, your article raises a number of really interesting points about NXS and kind of their place in music at this time, but I think one of the ones that I had never really considered is just sort of how, as you kind of mentioned, is how out of step it was with what was going on in rock at the time. You know, this was the era of, right, you know, either like big anthemic alternative rock, like, you know, U2 or Simple Minds. But on the other side, there was, you know, there was hair metal, and NXS doesn't really fit into any of this. It's not really like a chest beating band. And this album has that kind of hybrid sound. It's sort of part pop, part funk, part rock, part soul. It was very out of step with what was going on at the time. You ended up writing about it for us for its 30th anniversary. How did this article kind of come about? Was it a story that you had interest in pursuing? Because you come across some interesting revelations.
My editor had mentioned it to me, and at first we were kind of approaching it as, you know, this band used to be the biggest thing in the universe.
Sure.
When this record came out, it was huge. And to kind of go back and look at it again and look at that time and what was so remarkable about it, does it hold up? What went into making this surprise hit that was going, you know, so far in the other direction of what was happening musically at the time? And certainly never anticipating it becoming, you know, such an involved story. We thought it was just going to be like, let's take another listen. This is a classic album, and it's still a classic album if you listen to it today. This is still hold up, and that's what it started out being. And then, you know, I start talking to people, and the plot thickens, as they say.
Yeah, and you know, you talk to the band's manager, I guess, Chris Murphy. You talk to Andrew Ferris, who was a, you know, guitarist for the band, and some interesting people from the label of that time. And I guess the central revelation of your piece is that, at least according to some, that Atlantic Records kind of wanted to kill this album when they first heard it, that the band played "Need You Tonight" for the label, which was obviously, you know, the first single, and it went out to be a huge hit, and they were horrified by it, or at the very least, they didn't get what they were going for.
That was the story. I mean, at least according, I mean, this mythology really comes from Chris Murphy, who was the longtime manager for NXS up until, I believe, the mid-90s, and he released his autobiography or memoir not long ago that kind of looked at his quote-unquote remarkable career, and he talked about Kick, and his one of his big stories is that when the album was done, he brought it in to Doug Morris, who is then the president of Atlantic, and played him the entire record. They just sat in his record, sat in his office, the two of them, and listened to it from beginning to end. And according to Murphy, after it was done, Doug Morris said, "I'll give you $1 million to erase the tapes and just start from scratch." Which, you know, for Chris, for the whole band, was devastating news. And, I mean, remarkable news, if you think about it. He's not even just saying this hit-making band, because they had, this was not like a band that had come out of nowhere. They had just released Listen Like Thieves, which had, you know, What You Need, which was the band's first top 10 in the U.S. So there was reason to believe that they had a sound that would sell. But that the president of Atlantic would say, "I will give you $1 million just to pretend this didn't exist." I mean, that's crazy. So that's Chris's story. And then, you know, according to him, what happened next is he left the office and said, "You know what? We're gonna do this anyway. I'm gonna have to force Atlantic to put it out. I have to prove to them that this is an album full of hits. So we're gonna approach college radio. We're going to just have the band tour and kind of get a grassroots thing going and you know, talk to MTV and figure out ways to make this record seem, you know, impossible for Atlantic to turn down." So that's Chris Murphy's story. Then I call Doug Morris and ask him about this, and he has no idea what I'm talking about. His reaction was like, "I love the album. There was what is Chris talking about? No, I knew it was fantastic that that Michael Hutchins guy, he was born to be a star," completely disagreed with everything Chris Murphy said. So then, you, I mean, you know, as a journalist, you have a tricky situation. You have a he said, he said, in which nobody else was in the room. And one person saying, no, that's BS. And the other saying, oh, that absolutely happened. And if INXS didn't have me on their side, there never would have been a kick.
Does one of those arguments scan as more credible to you than the other one?
When you start, I talked to a lot of people at Atlantic who had been there, who are still there working in promotions and working in sales and working in every aspect of the company. And they all say we can't say for certain what happened because we weren't in that office. It would be speculation at best. But none of them heard a peep about this. And it seems curious to me that the president of Atlantic would make this offer and have these strong feelings about a record, and yet nobody else would hear a word about this. Nobody in any level of the company heard that there might be delaying or canceling the release of the album. So that seems to make Doug Morris, his side of the story, seem a little bit more plausible. Also, Chris Murphy, the one thing everyone will tell you about him is he does like his own mythology. he is not only his own mythology, but the band mythology. I think in his head, he thinks it's a better story if we were completely denied and we had to fight for this music to be heard. I mean, it's possible. It's entirely possible that Doug Morris, as brilliant as he is, didn't entirely get it. It was maybe because it's so different, as we discussed, with everything else on the radio. Maybe he was hoping for something that was more clearly had a clear genre to it, that was easy to pigeonhole and sell. So it's possible that he just showed a little bit of uncertainty and then somehow in Chris's head, he's like, he offered me $1 million.
Yeah, I mean cool. The $1 million part is really, like, I remember when we were discussing this article in The Office, I heard that amount and my jaw dropped. It seems so improbable. And I have to say that, like, it doesn't sound particularly plausible to me. I mean, as far as Kick, not sounding like rock radio in 1987, that's fair enough. But it does still sound like INXS. Right. I mean, obviously, Listen Like Thieves was a slightly more traditionally rock album. But the line between the line between What You Need, which was obviously, as we said, it was a very big hit on its own right as the big single off Listen Like Thieves. The line between that and New Sensation, which is one of the big hits off this record, is pretty small. There's not a lot of distance traveled there. So to hear this album and be so shocked by it and so taken aback by it not being what you wanted INXS to produce, that you're willing to offer them seven digits to erase it, maybe stretches credibility a little bit. Now, what you do have on your side, or at least rather on Chris Murphy's side, is Andrew Ferris, the guitarist, who says that by his memory, the response to the album was, you can't put out this record. It doesn't sound like the hair band's wearing spandex. So he definitely remembers there being some sort of friction there and then some sort of pushback from Atlantic on it.
Exactly. And whether he was getting that directly from the label or if he was getting that from Chris Murphy, who's kind of trying to rally the troops and let them know that we're going to do this. I mean, it's hard to say, but it does seem like there was a sense in the band that the label wasn't 100% behind them and they would have to prove that this record could do something.
Sure. And the other part that you kind of touched on already, but I found particularly interesting, is when you talk about and numerous people confirm this in the story, although they have some differing opinions as to whose idea it was and who actually executed it. But the idea of marketing the album to college radio specifically first. Certainly by the time of Kick, this band had kind of outgrown college radio, at least as like a primary mode of promotion. And you would say that, a lot of the songs of this album, they sound almost too big for college radio. They don't fit in with kind of like the REM and their followers. That was probably the bedrock for a lot of alternative college radio stations at the time. But I'm curious, as somebody who was kind of around at the time, although I guess you were a little young to know how it really fit into the college radio scene. Like, was INXS cool in 1987? Was this like a band that people... like that cool people listen to?
That's a really good question. I don't remember. I mean, I was in college at like 88, 89, which was a little up to their time, but I don't recall them being cool. I remember as a teenager that the girls were in love with it and it was very danceable and yet it seemed rock and roll. But that's a fascinating question. Like, were they ever cool? Where was it? Was it to say INXS, I listen to Kick. Whoa, dude, you must have gotten that from a college radio station.
Yeah, it doesn't quite fit. Yeah, and the band themselves, yeah. I mean, and especially Michael Hutchins, the lead singer, obviously very much in the kind of the rock god mold of a Jim Morrison or a Mick Jagger. You can't really picture them, you know, touring college campuses, playing, you know, 1,000-seat venues, that sort of thing. Like, it seems like this was a band that was meant to be, if not the biggest band in the world, and certainly in the discussion, which they became shortly after Kick. What was it about this album specifically that you think kind of made the difference that kind of, you know, Listen Like Thieves obviously made them, you know, part of the discussion, but it wasn't really like a world conqueror the way that Kick was. What was it about Kick specifically that you think put them on that level of a U2 or a Guns N' Roses or really like the big boys of rock radio at the time?
I think it was so damn catchy. I mean, and that was kind of the point that I guess right after Listen Like Thieves, Andrew and Michael decided, okay, we're going to do this completely different. There was something about, Andrew talked a lot about this, there was something in the song What You Need that he didn't feel like that was just a hit, like there's a formula there, and we got to figure out what we are hitting at with that formula. So Andrew and Michael talked to the rest of the band and said, let's do this record differently. We're going to go away, just the two of us, and we're going to write a collection of songs. We're going to go hide out in Hong Kong and finish all these songs and then bring them back to the band, which is different than how they had worked up to that point. Usually everyone was contributing and they would kind of create songs organically together. But Andrew Rue was really thinking about like the formula of how to get something that he kept saying that sounds like the future, that sounds like something like, did I just take a time machine into the, you know, 10 years from now that felt like it didn't belong in the time.
Right, the 21st century is yesterday, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's what they're aiming for. And there are, I mean, listening to the album a lot recently, it doesn't sound dated. It doesn't sound like a lot of the big hits of the 80s. I mean, it does sound weirdly contemporary. So, and there's something in those guitar lines that, you know, maybe it's just because I listen to it too much, but I mean, it could be math. It could be a math equation, how catchy that is.
No, and that was really the thing that struck me kind of revisiting this album the last week or two is just the economy of the riffs. Like, the Need You Tonight riff, that might even be one of the more complex guitar riffs on this album, and it's still just, you know, three chords, kind of played very staccato, very very simply. And like New Sensation, which is, you know, follows most closely in the What You Need model, that's just two chords over and over again. It's almost like a Velvet Underground song, the way it's structured. They're so catchy.
Yeah.
You hear them once and you remember them forever. I don't think Andrew Ferris gets necessarily a lot of credit for this band's success. I think when you talk about NXS, you usually talk about Michael Hutchins. But I think that, you know, he, as kind of the primary sonic composer of this album, he had a ton to do with the band's success and just creating these kind of, you know, very compact riffs that are easily accessible and not really overloaded with heroics or even the kind of, you know, like, I don't know, the chest puffing of the hair metal scene at the time. But it just kind of spoke to everybody, it seems like, and a lot of the songs are kind of built around that.
He was very much an architect, and he describes himself that way too. And I mean, he's almost the opposite of a Keith Richards, who was, everything was just coming out of his gut. It seems like with Andrew, everything was coming out of his brain, and what's gonna affect people in a certain way. I mean, it's fascinating the way he approached it. That it wasn't about like getting together a bunch of guys with instruments and jamming. It was thinking about the way notes work together and what kind of effect they have on our emotions and our brains and what makes us want to get up. I mean, it's remarkable the way he did it, and it certainly shows in the outcome how huge. I mean, how many they had, like four hits, and if you play the record, it almost seems like, is this a greatest hits package? It's just memorable ditty after memorable ditty.
Yeah, and I think that that almost kind of hurts NXS's their notoriety in retrospect, in that like so much of what people remember about them is contained to this one album. as you mentioned, like, it's the approach that Andrew Ferris took to this album. It's a very pop sort of approach, and the fact that you kind of combined that kind of pop craftsmanship with Michael Hutchins's, you know, undeniable animalistic rock star charisma, that's a pretty potent package. It's not really surprising that it ended up taking over the world. But yeah, I mean, and and you know, talking about this album sort of sounding like a greatest hit set, it's almost unfair the way it's structured, because it's like the Joshua Tree, and it's like so many other albums of the late 80s. Def Leppard's Hysteria is like this too, where like the first four or five songs are the first four or five songs you know on the album, basically. I mean, they have the discipline to save Never Tear Us Apart for the second half, but aside from that, it's basically just hit after hit after hit. Now, digging a little deeper, are there any songs in this album that kind of stand out to you as either like a lost classic or a buried gem of some sort, like a song that you might not know just from kind of living in the world in the late 80s?
That's interesting, because I listened to it today like I listened to it back then. Like, it starts out strong. You got that first album, that first side that's just unbelievable. And then I always find myself distracted and going someplace else before. Like, I don't know if I've ever heard, like, I'm looking at the track listing right now, like Calling All Nations, Tiny Daggers.
Yeah.
I feel like I knew those songs, but they don't. They're like, I couldn't hum them to you right now. And it's interesting too, because at the time before, you know, now we look at it and like, what's clearly it's top heavy, that the first side is full of hits. But at the time, I mean, hearing from Murphy and from Andrew about this, that there was a lot of nervousness about what to lead with. That the band and the label was very, very determined that it's got to be Devil Inside. Devil Inside is the hit. That's going to be the first single. And Murphy pushed really hard for Needy Tonight, and he really thought, no, that's going to be the first one out. And it got so nerve-wracking for them. And apparently, you know, band members would be calling Murphy in the middle of the night and going, like, I'm really freaking out about this. We're putting out the wrong single. It's got to be Devil Inside. That's our hit. So even they were thinking about, like, well, we're going to have one strong single from this, and hopefully that supports the record. That'll be like, what you need on this record that's gonna carry it. I mean, I can't even fathom that, like, oh, don't worry, the whole first side is complete hit.
Yeah, and that is interesting, because I do think Devil Inside probably would have been the safer choice, because it does have a very kind of muscular rock feel to it. It's almost like a one-upping of a Billy Idol song, sort of. It's got that kind of leather jacket sound to it. You can picture, like, the video, you know, people riding on motorcycles through it, and like you could sort of see where that fits in on radio in 1987. Whereas Need You Tonight, it's a very sparse record. It's a very kind of almost minimalistic. So, I mean, I can count like three or four different times in that song where you can just hear Michael Hutchence breathing. And that's a pretty rare thing for a pop lead single. But Need You Tonight, that's the indelible song off this album. That's the song that, you know, 30 years later, I think, you know, maybe people don't know the name INXS, but they know Need You Tonight, and they'll hear that riff, and they'll instantly, you know, snap to recognition from it.
Right.
And yeah, like you say, you know, I do think there are there's some good songs in the second half of this album. I think, you know, Tiny Daggers maybe could have been a single. I think that you know, Wild Life is fine, but you know, I owned this album on cassette when I was growing up, and I don't know how many times I even made it to the second side. It's pretty overwhelming just how fantastic the first side of this album is. So it's not surprising that the second half kind of pales in comparison. Now we talked a little bit about how, you know, this was the album for INXS, basically. You know, they've had other hits before that. They've had other hits since it. But when you think of INXS, you think of this album. Do you have any kind of theory as to why they never quite, you know, got to this level again? Was it just that music passed them by? Or did they kind of take too long of a break after Kick? What's your theory about that?
It could be everything from when you hit that peak. Do you ever, you know, recreate that energy again? Can you make? I mean, there's a lot of pressure when you have a record that's not this big, but like is almost a greatest hits package. So I think it might be partly like all of a sudden. And I talked a little bit about this with Andrew. It was a little bit about overthinking at that point. Mm-hmm. You get caught up in your own celebrity at a certain extent, and also music was on the cusp of changing. I mean, it was if not that same year, I think it was 1988 when Guns N' Roses were coming out, and which was, you know, starting to change the music a little bit.
Sure.
So they you know, weren't going to be cast aside by Nirvana and grunge and everything else, but they were very, you hear their music, and they were very caught up in the and kind of the I don't want to say the music of the 80s because it still works today, but you very much think of 1987, 1988 when you think of NXS. So I think it might really just come down to, you know, you made this gigantic success, and when you start thinking about making another gigantic success, you can get too caught up in your head. Like being the architect that Andrew was, maybe you can't go back to that same drawing board again and get the perfect formula the second time around.
Yeah, and I also wonder if, you know, the fact that they were such a pop-constructed band at this point, if that... You know, if that hurt them with kind of the, you know, Michael Hutchence otherwise, he lives the rock mythology almost to a cliche. You know, he has the supermodel wife and the incredible kind of history of sexual prowess and just glamour and drugs and, you know, the entire story before, you know, his untimely death in 1997, which, you know, depending on who you believe, was either suicide or, you know, despondency over not getting to see his kid or just an autoerotic asphyxiation gone awry. He should be kind of that sort of Jim Morrison venerated figure, you know, 16-year-old high school boys wanting to grow up to be him. But it just doesn't quite work out like that because they were generally a pop band, and his lyrics don't require any kind of deeper reading. No one's going to confuse Michael Hutchence's lyrics for poetry. But he was kind of a pop star in a rock star's body, if that makes sense. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah. It's interesting because when anyone I've talked to about him, like, you know, MTV VJs like Alan Hunter to, you know, the Atlantic guys, everyone, the way they talk about him is they're like, he was the next Mick Jagger. Mm-hmm. He was the Jim Morrison for that generation. They use all these venerable figures. But you're right. I mean, today you're never going to go to a college dorm room and see somebody, you know, with Michael's shirtless poster up on their walls.
Probably
but
not.
But Mick Jagger will be up there. I mean, mm-hmm. Jim Morrison continues to be up here. And you know, certainly the Doors had possibly less hits than NXS did. So maybe it is that pop thing. As sexy as it was and as unique as that sound was at the time, it was just maybe a little too poppy for that legend to transcend into something that was of a James Dean level. But yeah. Really, that energy, you go watch those videos or live shows again. I mean, it's not, you know, an exaggeration to go. He had that Mick Jagger,
sure,
you know, Jim Morrison, Elvis Presley energy and sexual bravado about him.
But even if the band doesn't quite make it to the rock history books the way that maybe you would think they would or that they arguably should have, you could say that the fact that they were a pop band makes them actually more relevant to 2017 than a lot of their rock peers at the time. I mean, you have a great line. I think it's the kicker of your story where Chris Murphy says that if Shawn Mendes had released Need You Tonight today, that it would be a gigantic hit. And usually when people say things like that about, you know, you could release that song today and it'd still be a hit, it's like, maybe, but probably not. I could hear it. Like I could see it happening with someone like him or Charlie Puth. Like there are songs on the radio now that you change kind of a couple of lyrics, a couple of things about the beat, and it sounds a lot like Need You Tonight.
Yeah.
So how do you see the band's, you know, contemporary relevance kind of sticking around in 2017?
It does seem poised for a comeback. Mm-hmm. It could, you know, get a renewed interest again. I don't know. They're re-releasing or they're coming out with a reissue of the album again,
sure,
with I don't know how many CDs. But with the documentary on Michael Hutchence that's coming out, there could, you know, people have the public has a way of rediscovering some of these acts that they've abandoned. So it's possible. I mean, who the heck knows? Because I mean, what Murphy said about being able to re-record this song, he's 100% right. He may be full of BS about everything else, but that is true.
Yes.
Like if you couldn't re-record George Michael's, you know, I Want Your Sex, and it'd be like, that's contemporary, that sounds fresh to my ears. I mean, a lot of the big hits back then, they could not be re-recorded.
Sure.
But I think 100% there's something to the music that stands the test of time. And I don't know. Yeah, I got an inkling in my gut that it could be Michael may still get the iconic status that he deserves. NXS may get you know, reexamined in a new light.
All right. Well, here's hope, and I'll certainly, you know, lead the charge on that one, along with you and this awesome piece that you wrote for us. If you haven't read it yet, hopefully it's up by now. Go and check it out. Eric Spitznagel, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on, Andrew.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.